Today for me has been following in the footsteps of Freddie. Because here I am tonight, and this morning I was preaching in Newton Breda. Two of the churches where Freddie has spent much of his ministry, I've been preaching there. I preached in Valamina earlier this year, so I've almost got the full set. This evening we're going to be thinking about the subject, part of the series that you've been doing on Sunday nights, What is God's Will for My Life? And the particular one tonight, it's a really straightforward one. There's nothing to think about or to worry about or anything like that at all. It's very simple. It has to do with living in submission to the government, human institutions. So it's fairly straightforward. We'll be done in plenty of time for you to get away to the Bangor Missionary Convention. I was actually going to say, but before I started, I was going to say that for those of you who are going off to the convention tonight, if I show no sign of stopping and you're getting a little nervous, just feel free to slip out. And then I realized that we're actually only 6:45. I'm supposed to stop at 6:30. So really, if I'm still going at 8 o'clock, you probably all want to leave by then, whether you're going to the convention or not. But let's turn to the passage, particular passage that's connected with this tonight. And it's 1 Peter chapter 2. And it's just a few verses there, beginning at verse 13. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13. I'm going to read to verse 17. Be subject for the Lord's sake, or be in submission for the Lord's sake, to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor or the king as supreme, or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Just around this time last year, Pauline and I were in England for a few days. We had some friends, and their son was getting married in Carlisle, and we'd been invited to the wedding. And we decided we would stay on for a few days in the Lake District, just a short distance from where we'd been at the wedding. And it just so happened, some of you will appreciate what I'm about to say, some of you may feel sorry for me. But it just so happened that on the Monday night of the week that we were in the Lake District staying in Windermere, it just so happened that it was the first night of the Premier League football season. Now, if you're a Manchester United supporter, you really ought to remember this quite well, because you went to Everton and you lost 1-0. I'm an Everton supporter. There's no real rationale for that, but there you have it. And I was able, through the kindness, this is even more incredible, I was even able, through the kindness of a friend who's a Liverpool supporter, to get two tickets for the match. I didn't even take any money for them. So with my friend, whose son had just got married, we drove off an hour and a half or whatever down the motorway, went to Liverpool, watched the game. It was a marvelous evening, and we were heading back. We were almost back at our bed and breakfast in Windermere. It was about midnight. There was nobody on the road. And just shortly before we got into Windermere, we drove through this very small village whose name I don't even remember. And it was a 40-mile-an-hour speed limit. And there were no other cars on the road. And unfortunately, I think I was doing 46. And even more unfortunately, a light flashed as I drove through the village. I'd been speeding. I actually thought I'd got away with it for some reason, because it was really only about 4 months later, just before Christmas, wonderful timing, that the letter arrived in the post, and there you go, 3 penalty points, or go and spend your morning listening to somebody talking about the hazards of speed. 3 penalty points and a little opportunity to contribute to the finances of the Cumbria Constabulary, which I paid. Now, that's part of what it means to live as a citizen of these islands. In fact, even if you're just a visitor to these islands, it applies to you as well. I'm sure they've got ways of coming after you, even if you live in Austria or something like that. I'm sure the European Union and various trade agreements have ways of getting speeding fines to you as well. It's part of how you relate to the state, isn't it? Let me tell you another story. This is a bit more serious. It's about something that happened in America. 2006, so that's 8 years ago. No, it's not. Is it? 7 years ago? 7 years ago, a Christian couple who have a photography business were asked to take photographs at a ceremony. It wasn't a normal wedding ceremony. It was a ceremony to recognize a same-sex partnership. Now, this couple, because of their Christian beliefs and their convictions, they felt they could not take the job, and so they turned it down. Now, by the way, let me just say, I know that not every Christian photographer will take the same view, and the purpose of this evening is not to say what Christian photographers should or should not do in situations like that. This couple chose not to because of their conscience. And the people who were having the ceremony went ahead and they found somebody else who would take their photographs. Turns out they were actually cheaper than the Christian couple, so it was a really good deal for them all round. But they weren't happy. And so they went to some human rights organization, institution in New Mexico, which is where they all lived, and they registered a complaint about discrimination. And the photographers were found guilty, and they were fined. They appealed it. In some senses, they might as well not have bothered because nothing changed. In fact, one of the judges in the appeal hearing said that those Christian photographers, he said, are now compelled by law to compromise the very religious beliefs that inspire their lives. Compelled by law to compromise the very religious beliefs that inspire their lives. He went on to say, at its heart, this case teaches that at some point in our lives, all of us must compromise, if only a little, to accommodate the contrasting values of others. And it went on. These Christians, he said, they're free to pray to whatever God they choose, but there is a price, one that we all have to pay somewhere in our civic life. This couple have to channel their conduct, not their beliefs, so as to leave space for other Americans who believe something different. The compromise is part of the glue that holds us together as a nation, the tolerance that lubricates the various moving parts of us as a people. Now, my story about a traffic speeding fine is rather trivial compared with that. The prospects for these people's business, the fact that they lost several thousand dollars that were awarded against them in terms of costs. How do you relate to the state in circumstances like that? Or what should we make of someone like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the famous German pastor and Christian who was executed right at the end of the Second World War? And the reason he was executed was on the orders of Hitler himself. He was executed because of the part that he had played in a plot to assassinate Hitler. Or, this morning, you will have heard from Ramiz Atala, right? Was he here this morning? No, he wasn't. He was to have been here this morning. He was advertised, but he wasn't. Some of you may have heard him speaking last night at the convention. But there you have a brother, and many of his fellow citizens have recently taken to the streets and removed an elected president. Now, I'm sure that if you got talking to him, he would give you a very stark view of the reality of what it is to live as a Christian in Egypt. He would probably also want to point out that some of the ways that the whole situation has been portrayed in the West by Western media hasn't necessarily been a fair and a balanced representation. But what do you do? How do you relate to the state in circumstances like that? What do you do if you live in North Korea? What would you have done if you had been living, say, in somewhere like Romania at the end of the 1980s? How do you relate to the state? Now, with all those kinds of questions in our minds, we come to Scripture and we come to a passage like 1 Peter. Now, I have to say, this is going to maybe, some of you may be frustrated and you may be saying in a couple of minutes, just get to 1 Peter and get on with it. But before we get to 1 Peter, I want to take a few minutes to sketch in some biblical background and just a little bit of historical background. Some biblical background that we can set this question in. First of all, in relation to the Old Testament. Now, you read the Old Testament and you know that there are many nations that are talked about in the Old Testament. Most of them are ites of some kind, or many of them seem to be ites of some kind. But there are Egyptians, there are Babylonians, there are Persians, many, many nations, some of them small groups of people, some of them powerful empires in the Old Testament. But you realize, and only if you're just even slightly familiar with the Old Testament, you realize that the nation that gets more attention than any other nation in the Old Testament is the nation of Israel. Now, eventually it's divided into Judah in the south and Israel in the north. But these people, this nation of Israel, is formed by the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And more than just being the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they are the people that God has chosen to be his people. He's chosen to live among them. And so you discover as you read through the Old Testament that there's a uniqueness about this nation. For they are a nation who are defined by the actions of God and by the words of God. How did their nation come about? Think of Exodus. Think of the story of Exodus and the great liberation that they experienced when really they were just a collection of families, a very large collection of families. But through the action of Exodus and the redemption, and then the eventual arrival in the promised land, those actions of God of redeeming and of giving them the land is part of what defined them as a nation. And they're defined by the words of God, because God spoke to them through Moses and gave them laws. Laws that were meant to govern their lives and actually meant to define the kind of people that they would be. And you discover that those laws cover all kinds of things, from morality to details of how you were to approach God and worship and the sacrifices that you were to bring, right to the detail, for example, of if you build a new house and you've got a flat roof on your house, the law said that you had to make sure that you build a little parapet or a little fence around the edges of the wall. Why? So that your neighbor, if he happens to be taking a stroll on your flat roof, doesn't fall over the edge and you're held responsible for his death. The law defined even details like that. And so you've got this nation, this unique nation, descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, defined by the actions and by the words of God, and they're governed by God's laws. That's the theory, at least. They often rebelled against it. And there they are, living in their land. However, they also discovered that if they were disloyal to this God who had called them, who'd formed them as a nation, if they were disloyal to him, there would be trouble. And so you find towards the end of their stories in the Old Testament, they're exiled. The northern tribes are exiled among the Assyrians. And the southern tribes and the city of Jerusalem come under the power of the Babylonians, so that Jerusalem is destroyed and the southern tribes are exiled to places. They're exiled to Babylon. And you find them saying things like what you get in the Psalms, where they say, "How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land?" But God didn't forget them. And you get stories of people like Daniel and Nehemiah and Esther. And all of those stories give us some idea, begin to give us some clue as to what it means to relate to the state when you're scattered among other nations, like among the Babylonians. And of course, there's that famous letter to the exiles in Jeremiah. It's got that verse that we like to quote often. You know, you often like to encourage your friends with it. "I know the plans that I have for you, plans to prosper you, to give you a hope and a future." A wonderful verse. And sometimes we quote it and we refer to it and we write it and send it to people. And we forget what the context of it actually is. It's a letter that's written to people who are living in exile, far away from Jerusalem, saying, "How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land?" They're far away. A message comes from God through Jeremiah and says, "You know what? You're going to be there for 70 years. And you can almost imagine reading between the lines, there's some of them, and they'd be thinking, "We're going to be here for 70 years. There's no way we're going to be here for 70 years. We're going to fight this. We're going to start an insurrection. We're going to have a guerrilla army. We're going to get ourselves back to Jerusalem." God says, "Don't even think about it. You're going to be there for 70 years. And while you're there, I want you to seek the welfare of the city that you're living in. Because if that city prospers, you will prosper as well. And he says, I know the plans that I have for you to give you a hope and a future. And of course, that points us forward to what eventually happens in their story. And no doubt, in a fuller way, even beyond that. So that's a little bit about the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. When you come to the New Testament, you discover something different about the nature of the people of God. Remember, in the Old Testament, the nature of the people of God is, here is a nation formed by God, shaped by God, defined by God, ruled over by God. In the New Testament, the people of God is not limited to one particular nation. It's not limited to one tribe or one color or one line of blood, one descent. It's not limited to that. You discover in the New Testament that God's vision is that through Jesus, there will be a people who transcend national boundaries. And are held together, not because they've got a shared culture and a shared history, but they're held together because of Jesus. And because in Jesus Christ, as it says in Galatians, there is neither Jew nor Greek. And to translate that into very simple Northern Irish terms, in Christ there is neither British nor Irish. Isn't that right? We're not defined by flags. The people of God in the New Testament are not identified with one particular state. Instead of that, you find the people of God scattered through many different nations. Sometimes there are lots of them, and as you go down through the history of the Christian church, sometimes there are lots of them all in one place. And sometimes when there are lots of them, they have a great deal of power and a great deal of influence. Historically, there have been times when the popes had more power than the kings. And you think about the Western world, where most of us have our heritage and most of us have our roots. In the Western world, we've got a history of something called a state church. Think about it. Even in the UK, the Queen, who is the head of state, ornamental in many ways, no doubt, is also the supreme governor of the Church of England. What a very privileged place in some senses for the Church of England, for a Christian church. And that has been the case in parts of the Western world. You can travel in Scandinavia, you can travel in other parts of the world, and you discover the influence of the state church. But what happens, and I think this is what's happening now, what happens when Christians are actually not the majority anymore? What happens when Christians start to lose their influence? What happens when what's been referred to as Christendom is on the wane? What happens in the Western world, because that's where we're living, what happens in the Western world when the church no longer enjoys a dominant and privileged position? When it actually starts to look a lot more like the first century. Where there they were scattered. First Peter, the opening verse, if you go back to chapter 1, verse 1, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who are elect exiles, that would have rung a few bells for the ones who were familiar with the Old Testament story, those who are elect exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, and so on. These people are exiles. Now, at the same time, chapter 2, verse 9, they are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession to proclaim the excellencies of the one who called them from darkness into his marvelous light. But then verse 11, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. When Peter was writing to these Christians in the first century, he was not writing to a group of people who were so numerous and so powerful and so influential that they could be called the state church, or were the head of their church, the most senior figure in their church was also a senior figure in the government. They were scattered almost as nobodies around these various places. And as Peter writes to them, he wants them to understand what it means to relate to the state. And so he says, verse 13, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, and so on. Now, all that's introduction. Let me give you 3 points. And for those of you who are kind of just glazing over, 3 points, the executive summary, you can take this and you can even go to sleep for the rest of it and go and figure these out. But here are the 3 points. Number one, submit to the government. Number two, silence the ignorant. And number three, serve the omnipotent. Now, I know that last one sounds unusual, but I wanted to try to make them all kind of, you know, not quite rhyme. But those of you who are preachers know what I mean. Submit to the government, silence the ignorant, and serve the omnipotent. Now, let's have a little look at what these mean. First of all, submit to the government. You notice that word at the beginning, verse 13, be subject to every human institution. Now, if you're reading the NIV, it says, submit yourselves. Now, drop down to verse 18 for a moment. And you'll see there that the theme changes a little bit, but there's a similar theme that's still running through it. In verse 18, he says, servants, be subject, same word, to your masters, or be submissive, submit yourselves to your masters. And if you keep going on down to chapter 3 and verse 1, he says there, likewise, wives, be subject, same word, to your own husbands. Now, there'd be plenty there. If we were to take all of those things, there'd be plenty to keep us going for quite a while and plenty to discuss about it. But notice the general point that Peter is making. He's saying that there is a structure to society. There is a structure and there's a certain order in terms of how people relate to each other. There's citizens who relate to the state. There are slaves who relate to their masters. There are wives who relate to their husbands. And the basic point that Peter is making running through this is that Christians, followers of Jesus, are to fit in with those structures. Now, it's interesting, by the way, and you may notice this if you look at it in more detail, but it's interesting that when he talks about submitting to the government, there's no counterbalancing instructions for governors, for example. And when he talks to slaves, there's no counterbalancing word to masters. You find that, for example, when Paul talks about slaves and masters in Ephesians. He says that, well, slaves, this is your responsibility to your masters. But, masters, don't you take that as an excuse to be oppressive and harsh on your servants. But here, in terms of government and in terms of slaves, there's no counterbalancing word. But notice when he gets to wives and he says to wives, be subject to your own husbands. And by the way, some of you may be thinking to yourself, goodness, this is all very well if you're in government or if you have slaves or if you're a man and you've got a wife. You know, it's a bit easy for all of those people. If you're in one of the other categories, it's not so easy. But notice what he says when he talks to wives and says that they're to be subject to their own husbands. He then goes on, you've got to go down to verse 7 in chapter 3. He says, likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. And we're not going to get into any of that, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life. Now, that's interesting, because whereas when he talks about government, he says, citizens, this is what you've got to do. He talks about slaves, this is what you've got to do. Talks to wives, this is what you've got to do. The only time there's a counterbalance where he speaks to the other group is when he speaks to the husbands. Now, men, please take note of that and make sure that you take that home with you tonight, those of you who are married. But I think probably the reason why he doesn't, you know, if he was to follow the pattern of wives being subjection to your husbands and husbands, you make sure that you treat them kindly and live in an understanding way with them. If he was to follow that pattern with slaves and also with citizens in the government, then you would have expected him to say, well, slaves, you submit to your masters, and masters, don't you abuse them. All of you submit to human institutions. And by the way, if you're a governor, you make sure that you govern justly and honorably. You'd expect him to say all of that. And I think the reason he doesn't is probably because of the nature of the church that he's writing to. Excuse me, there probably weren't very many of them who had servants and slaves. And there probably weren't very many of them, probably weren't any of them, who found themselves in government. Now, very specifically, we're looking at what he says about the structure in society. So there is a structure in society. Excuse me, there's an order in it. And Christians need to learn what it means to live in that order. Now, bear in mind what I said at the beginning. If we're talking about speeding fines in the UK, or if we're talking about parking on the double yellow lines, and those guys who are dressed up as Salvation Army people, but they're actually traffic wardens, those people come and give you a ticket. That is in the scheme of things, that's a very trivial thing. And it's easy to read 1 Peter chapter 2 in that kind of context. So much more difficult if you're Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Nazi Germany. So much more difficult if you're Ramiz Attallah in Egypt in 2013. And some of these other situations. But Peter's basic point is there is a structure, and he says you are to subject yourselves to that structure. Specifically, he mentions two groups. Now, here we've got a big cultural thing. We don't have an emperor. We have a sort of a democracy. Some of you may want to debate just how democratic our democracy actually is. But the actual details of the structure are different. Peter talks about a king or an emperor who is supreme. And then he talks about governors whose authority is delegated by the king, who are sent by him. Notice that they've got a dual role. He says they are to punish those who do evil, and they are to praise those who do good. That is how government is meant to work. God has ordained it. That's even clearer in Romans chapter 13 than it is here. God has ordained it. And he's ordained it and given authority to it so that the government will see to it that evildoers are punished, wrong is punished, and those who do good are actually held in honor and held in esteem. That's how it's meant to be. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work like that. But that is the responsibility of the state under God. And so Peter says, this is how the state is meant to function. Presumably this is before there's a lot of very severe persecution, state-sponsored persecution happening to these Christians. Presumably things are still fairly calm at the moment. But here's what Peter is saying. You subject yourself, you live in submission to that order. Now let me flag a couple of other New Testament passages at this point. And if you have your Bible, flick back to Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22 and verse 17 to 21. This is an incident where the Pharisees and the Herodians are trying to trap Jesus. You know that often happens in the Gospels. They think, well, we'll ask him a question. And we'll ask him the kind of question that no matter what way he answers it, he's going to get into trouble with somebody. And so they come along and they say, well, tell us this. What do you think about paying taxes? What do you think about paying taxes to Caesar? Now, no doubt in the back of their thinking, there is the thought that, well, if he says, yes, of course you should pay taxes to Caesar, well, we can say he's not loyal to these poor, oppressed Israelite people here. We're oppressed here in Palestine by these Roman occupiers. And here is Jesus, who's supposed to be standing up for his own people, and he's actually telling us that we're to recognize the legitimacy of the Roman government and pay taxes to Caesar. So they cause him to fall out with the people. On the other hand, if Jesus says, well, of course you shouldn't pay taxes to Caesar. Don't pay taxes to Caesar. In fact, take up weapons and go and get rid of Caesar. Well, it would be the easiest thing in the world for some of these Herodians to go and say, did you hear what that teacher is saying? He's advocating insurrection. And so they thought it was a no-win situation. And Jesus very, very wisely says, show me a coin. Takes a coin and says, whose inscription is this? Caesar's. He says, well, you make sure that you give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and also make sure that you give to God what is God's. And they can't say anything about that. He's left them with a challenge. Now, there's an interesting point that lies behind what Jesus says there. Because you'll notice that Jesus is recognizing two authorities. There is a divine authority. There is God. Give to God what is God's. But he's also recognizing a second authority. It's a political authority when he says, you're to give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Now that means that it is possible to be a devoted follower of God and to be a loyal citizen of the state. If it wasn't possible to do that, Jesus wouldn't have said what he said, right? Render to Caesar what is Caesar's, render to God what is God's. Now, what we're going to see a little later towards the end this evening is that there are actually times when being a loyal follower of God conflicts with what it means to be a loyal citizen of the state. And we'll say more about that when we come to it. But just notice that Jesus recognizes those two authorities. Go over to Romans chapter 13. I've already mentioned this, and I'll just highlight it again for you. Romans chapter 13, the first few verses of that, in a way, are Paul's equivalent of Peter, 1 Peter chapter 2. He says there that the governing authorities have been instituted by God. There is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God. That's a fairly broad statement. I was chatting with a friend yesterday morning. He's a CEF missionary. And just back in Northern Ireland for a week or so. There's not a lot of room up here, is there? I'm kind of going to knock things over. But he was back for a short time. We were chatting a little bit about this thing that I'm speaking about tonight. And he said that a number of years ago, must have been about 15 years ago, around the time of the Good Friday Agreement, he was leading a Bible study in a church. I'm not going to say where the church was, but he was leading a Bible study in the church. And the passage was this passage in Romans chapter 13. Which says there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Now, he said this in Northern Ireland at the time of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. There was a man there, it was a Bible study followed by prayer, and there was a man who actually turned out he was visiting the church, didn't belong there, and he started to pray. And he basically told God that what had been written in Romans 13 actually wasn't applicable in the case of Northern Ireland. I didn't actually use those words, but he said, God, we know that, of course, you have not put these people in power. Tricky, isn't it? Yet Paul makes a very wide, sweeping statement. Those that exist have been instituted by God. God has, at the very least, God has allowed them to be there. And so you see Peter's point, where Peter says, listen, folks, part of you living as scattered disciples of Jesus, scattered among the nations, many of whom do not like you. You see that in verses 11 and 12. People speak against them. Many of them don't like you. Part of what it means to live in that set of circumstances is that you live in subjection to every human institution, the king and the governor. Submit to the government. Second point. And this takes us to verse 15. Look at verse 15 where it says, this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Silence the ignorant. Now this, I think, is actually the connection between what is the will of God for my life that fits in with this series. The will of God for my life is that I should do good. And specifically, that by doing good I should silence the ignorance of the foolish. Now, what does that mean? Well, I think one thing, one of the implications of it, is that nobody should have an excuse to say that Christians are a destructive and harmful factor in society. That's what people were saying about these Christians. We go back up to verses 11 and 12, verse 12, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. So there are people who are speaking against them. They're reporting stories about them. The Christians have a bad reputation. And Peter says, if you're living as submissive citizens of the government, you're not causing social disorder, then if you are doing good, you actually take the ground from under the feet of the people who want to make these accusations against you. Do not give them an excuse to call you a destructive influence, a destructive factor in society. He says these people, again in verse 12, these people will see your good deeds and they'll glorify God on the day of visitation. Now this idea of good deeds is quite significant in 1 Peter. It's there in chapter 2, verse 12. It's there again in chapter 2, verse 15. This is the will of God that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. You get it again in chapter 3, verse 11. Let him turn away from evil and do good. chapter 3, verse 13. Who is there to harm you if you're zealous for what is good? Chapter 4, verse 19, he says, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. Now, I think there's a couple of reasons why we don't talk very much about doing good. One is that there's a sort of a perception that if you're a do-gooder, nobody wants to be a do-gooder, do they? You know, who's goody-two-shoes coming along now? Nobody wants to be thought of as a do-gooder or a goody-goody. Nobody likes to be thought of. There's also a theological reason I think some of us are nervous about it. We worry that if we talk too much about good deeds and doing good deeds, we're going to give people the impression that if they can just be good enough by themselves, they won't need Jesus to save them. And of course, that would be a denial of why Jesus has gone to the cross. But I wonder if there's a danger that we shy away from it and we don't actually talk about good deeds too much. And yet Jesus talked about good deeds. Jesus said to his followers, he said, let your light shine before men so that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father who is in heaven. You got that in the Sermon on the Mount. You get a very similar thing in Luke chapter 6 where he talks about doing good to other people and lending to other people and not just doing good to the people who do good to you. He talks about doing things that are going to benefit other people. And here's Peter who says, this is how you got to live. Here's how you'll silence the accusations of the ignorant. Now that all sounds very easy, doesn't it? You know, you've got all these people who don't like Christians, and if you just go out and do some good things and live a good life, they're all going to say, oh, sorry, we made a mistake. And if it sounds that simple, then you've only got to start thinking about people like Richard Dawkins or people like the late Christopher Hitchens, who actually wrote a book where the subtitle of it was How Religion Poisons Everything. And although he used the word religion in the title, he didn't have kind things to say about Christianity in the middle of that book. Actually, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens are evidence of verse 12. What do you do when you're attacked by Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens? You go on living a life that is marked by good deeds. Let me give you another story that shows you another side of it. I think it was in 2008 that Matthew Paris, he's a columnist, a newspaper columnist, he's an atheist, wrote a piece in the Times on the influence of Christianity in Africa. An atheist writing about the influence of Christianity in Africa. And you can sort of imagine what an article like that might be like. And you maybe would think he'd be very skeptical about the influence of Christianity in Africa. You might expect him to bring out the old arguments and say, you know, all of those people have their own culture and Christians from the West should just leave them alone. And as people have gone in, they've tried to impose other customs on them. They've brought all kinds of diseases that these people are suffering from. They've done so much harm to these people. Or you might expect that he would say, look, if the missionaries want to go there and actually do some good to the people and keep their and build hospitals and dig wells and do all that kind of thing and just keep their beliefs to themselves, well, fair enough. But here's what he actually does say. He admits that in the past he used to like to make those kinds of criticisms. He used to like to say, well, the practical stuff is fine, but can you leave all of this salvation business out of it? But that's not how he sees it any longer. He's changed his view. Now, it must be very uncomfortable for him because he's decided there's no God. But yet, he writes that there's no question that Christianity has made a positive difference in people's lives. And this is what he says, and I quote him. He says, now a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa, sharply distinct from the work of secular non-governmental organizations, government projects, and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. Now, they're there. They're preaching a message of salvation, and this man recognizes it. But, of course, they're doing good along with other people as well. I think that sometimes when we think about what does it mean to be good, it's all very individualistic. What it means to be good is there's a whole list of things I won't do, a whole lot of bad things I won't do. What if We were actually to do good in a positive, outgoing way and start to make positive contributions to our neighbors, positive contributions to the well-being of our communities, and positive contributions to the well-being of our society. Peter says, you will silence the ignorant, the ignorance of the foolish. You will silence that by doing good. People will notice. Now, I'm sure Peter, I know that Peter would be quite happy to qualify that in the way that we're going to qualify it in a moment. There will always be the Richard Dawkinses who will not want to see any of the good that is done, who want to argue it away. But here is a biblical issue. What does it mean to do the will of God? What does it mean to live faithfully as a Christian, scattered in a state, in a country, in a nation, under a government that does not necessarily govern by the laws of God? You submit to the government and you silence the ignorant by doing what is good. Now, it's not necessarily always going to work. I said Peter would be quite prepared to qualify it. And it's quite clear if you go down to verse 20. He says, what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. If when you do good and suffer for it, you endure. Peter realized that while he had this view that they submit to the government, that they do what is good, and that that will have an impact, people will notice, and even if they don't notice now, they will notice, he says in verse 12, on the day of visitation, when God eventually comes to sort the whole thing out, people will be forced to say, ah, those people were a good influence after all. But Peter recognizes all of that. He also recognizes that there will be some people who will do what is good. It will not be recognized. In fact, they will suffer for it. And when that's happening, we have to realize the third thing. Serve the omnipotent. Verse 16, live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Christians are free. But that freedom is not an excuse just to do whatever they want and to do evil. Because Peter makes it clear that you are free, but you are servants of God. That is your ultimate status. That is how you really are defined. Yes, you're free, but more importantly, you are a servant of God. Yes, you are free, but you use your freedom not as an excuse just to be an insurrectionist, but you use your freedom to submit to the governing authorities and to do good. Christians are free, but as servants of God, we submit to the government. Verse 17, we honor the king, but you notice also that we honor everyone. And it doesn't say honor God, it says fear God. Someone told me that C.S. Lewis in his book, The Horse and His Boy, someone pointed me to a little quotation from that. In The Horse and His Boy, there's a talking horse. Remarkable, isn't it? Talking horse. And this horse is talking about the Tisroch, who was the Calorman emperor. And normally, it says in the book, in the early chapters of the book, normally when citizens mention the Tisroch, they add a little phrase at the end of it. When they mention the Tisroch, they say, may he live forever. However, the talking horse has mentioned the Tisroch and hasn't said, may he live forever. And so I think it's another younger horse says, what's happening here? Why don't you say, may he live forever? And the talking horse says, I'm a free Narnian, and why should I talk slaves and fools talk? I don't want him to live forever, and I know that he's not going to live forever, whether I want him to or not. Now, that probably sounds disrespectful, and you know, I urge you to be careful the way you would use that and the people whose names you would put in there to quote that. But it is a reminder that our ultimate allegiance, even though we're to be in subjection to government, our ultimate allegiance is not to the government. Our ultimate allegiance is to God. And as you are well aware from things that I've already said this evening, there will be times when honoring the king and fearing God will not go together. Render to Caesar what is Caesar's. Render to God what is God's. And as much as it is possible to do both of those, we must do both of those. But we need to recognize, and frankly, the way things are changing in the Western world, without wanting to be overly dramatic about it, we may need to, some of us may need to be ready for situations like this where we realize that it is not possible to fear God and submit to what the government asks us to do. What about Bonhoeffer in Nazi Germany? Here's what Bonhoeffer said. Christians are, therefore, faced with a dilemma when assaulted by evil. They must oppose it through direct action. They have no other option. Any failure to act is simply to condone evil. Now, that's a fascinating discussion. What do you do to resist evil? But even without going that far, what are the situations where you may have to refuse to do what you're told? Peter said, be in subjection to the government. But what happens when your ultimate allegiance to God comes into conflict with your temporal allegiance and relative allegiance to your government? How does that work? Well, it's dotted throughout Scripture. And I think one of the most significant books that relates to this is the book of Daniel, the first half of the book of Daniel. And the first half of the book of Daniel is all about what does it mean to serve God when the king's a pagan? And so at the beginning of Daniel, you've Daniel, he's been ripped out of Jerusalem as a young man. He's been ripped out of Jerusalem and Judah. He's been taken away. He's obviously a bright guy. He's been selected for fast track, great education program, great program of enculturation so that he becomes a good, well-educated Babylonian. And there's a line that he draws because there's a day when he says that he could not defile himself with the king's meat. Or it's Daniel who ends up in a lion's den because he refuses to obey a law, an unjust law, that would have limited his religious expression. Or it's Daniel's friends who refuse to bow to the king's statue. Or in the New Testament, it's the early apostles. And the Jewish authorities are getting really nervous as the gospel is spreading. The Jewish authorities are getting really nervous. And they say, look, we told you that you were not to talk in this name Jesus. And they say, well, look, figure this out for yourselves. What should we do? Should we obey you? Or should we obey God? And very clearly there are times in Scripture and times and situations that people are faced with across the face of the earth where it's not possible to fear God and have Him as your ultimate allegiance and do exactly what the state is asking you to do. And someone has said that believers are always to obey government when it takes its place under God, but they should never obey it when it takes the place of God. I think that's very helpful. Always to obey government when it takes its place under God, but never to obey it when it takes the place of God. And I think that means that there are many times when submission to the government, as Peter talks about submission for the Lord's sake to every human institution, there'll be many times when that is expressed in obedience to the laws that the government has brought about. But there may be times when submission to the government will actually not be to do what the government asks you to do, but it will be to submit to the penalty that the government imposes upon you because you refuse, because you cannot do what it has asked you to do. I know there are many of us, and we probably wring our hands, at some of the decisions that have been taken by the government of this country, expressed in legislation, and understandably we wring our hands. And what do? Well, two things. Let's not forget 1 Timothy chapter 2 with its injunction to pray for the authorities and the goal of that we would live an ordered and a godly life. And the second thing is that we need to keep on doing good. That doesn't change. And what if the future of the church in this country and the future of the church in much of the Western world is quite different from the past, where even centuries ago there was political power. and even decades ago where there was great influence and the church was held in great honor. What happens if in future it's not going to be like that? But actually the way of witness is not going to be to try to get the laws changed, but the way of witness is to be doing good and seeking the welfare of our communities. And sometimes that godly life will mean suffering for what is right. And Peter knew it, as we've said. And that's why, and I close with this, that's why he says in verse 21, "For this, to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow his steps." He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he was suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. For you were straying like sheep, but you've now returned to the shepherd and the overseer of your souls. You've got the heart of the gospel in there. It's a message which saves us. But you'll also notice here that it's a message that's meant to shape us. Because Peter says, you know, you may well suffer for doing what is right. Don't stop doing what is right. You may well suffer for it. But when it happens, you look at Jesus. And you look at Jesus who suffered, who submitted himself even to suffering. But as he did so, he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. And that's, you see, ultimately where our hope has to be. The one who judges justly. God will judge Mr. Mubarak. He will judge President Morsi. He will judge David Cameron. He will judge Barack Obama. We're also accountable to him, aren't we? And we need to remember that. And we need to remember that our primary loyalty is to him. Submit to the government, silence the ignorant, and serve the omnipotent.